Hello, I'm Jim Cornell, and this is the WalkingPost.com podcast. WalkingPost.com is the news website dedicated to walking, with all the latest on gear, books, events, fitness, health, festivals and trails, and more. This podcast is number 32, and it's going out on October the 24th. I think I've just about recovered from my trips, other than the fact that I've got loads of interviews to edit now. I think that's it for trips in 2025, but you never know, and I mean other than within Scotland. It's also that really confusing time of the year when countries change the clocks again, and they all do it at different times. At least once in the past I set up an interview without taking it into account. That was a nice mess. I did get a good walk in on Saturday, another part of the Fife Coastal Path, which is just stunning, especially around Pittenweem and Crail. There was no wind either, so we got to film with the drone, other than the fact that my son flew it into my knee. So just in case it was on your bucket list, it hurts. Let's see what's special about October the 24th. It's World Kangaroo Day, United Nations Day, World Polio Day, and Zambia Independence Day. In terms of events, it's the day the world's first football club was formed in Sheffield, and it was the day of Houdini's last performance. It's also the day the first photo of the Earth from space was taken. If it's your birthday, you share it with Wayne Rooney, Kevin Klein, and Drake. On last week's podcast, we had a conversation with Mark Hines, an endurance athlete and author of Hiking the Yukon Quest. This week, we're talking about another long-distance feat with feet. And it's with Greg Keeney, who walked the entire coast of New South Wales in Australia. And so you know, it's more than 1,000 miles. Before we get going, if you do have news, guest ideas, or even subjects to cover, or comments, or if you want to advertise, please do get in touch via walkingpost.com, or you can just email me directly at jim@walkingpost.com. Okay, now that things are a little bit more back to normal again, let's go through some of the headlines of the news articles you may have missed that we had on walkingpost.com this past week. Koros debuted its Apex 4 watch, a new Eastern European video game is billed as a walking simulator, and the Adirondack Rail Trail in New York State is now open for year-round use. A walking, wheeling and cycling route has opened in Sevenoaks. Walking is at the heart of Lebanon's cultural and natural tourism drive, and £1.8 million of funding has been secured for Nottingham walking improvements. There is a new walking trail from Sheffield to Manchester, and it looks great. Canada has invested in trail reconstruction on McNabb's Island, which is close to the city of Halifax, Nova Scotia, and you can read all of these and more at www.walkingpost.com. Right, this week we're taking a trip, although not literally, along the coast of New South Wales in Australia with Greg Keeney. It's a long walk. It's more than 1,000 miles to be precise, and there are also more than 1,000 beaches. So clearly it takes a while, especially if you go for a lie down on every one of those beaches. So let's hear all about it and no doubt get inspired to want to go and do it. Hi Greg, great to have you on the podcast. First, maybe could you set the scene for us a little bit, maybe?
I grew up in Australia. I grew up in Sydney, and yes, I've always loved the beach, and I think the correct word's the liminal zone, you know, where the land meets the water. And Australia, as you're probably aware, is very much a land of coastal dwellers, and beaches and things loom large for us. In my youth, I did trek across Borneo. So that was sort of something, I guess, the first time I'd done along. It was not necessarily just trekking. It was sort of boats up rivers and walking across mountains, but that was a really big thing. But really the genesis for this began in COVID. Like for so many people, I was thinking, well, in Australia, we were restricted by state and these borders had never meant anything really. Then suddenly it was like, you can't leave, in my case, New South Wales. So I just started thinking, well, okay, well, if that's the future, what would I do? And one day I was in a cafe and the friend I was meeting was a bit late. I just had my phone, looked on Google Maps and thought, well, there's a lot of big stretches of national park and a lot of sort of green areas on Google Maps. And then there's a lot of yellow areas for beaches and it all looks pretty doable. And now it's just the details for it. So yeah, really it was then. And in the summer of 21, 22, I walked all the Sydney beaches with my brother. And there's about 100 beaches in the sort of Sydney, the greater Sydney metropolitan area. So we just walked north to south. And even in a place that I knew very well, as many people know with hiking, when you actually set a goal and you're going to do every bit, I realised, oh, this is just fantastic. And I couldn't wait to get started on doing the whole coast. So, yeah, so I'm a pretty keen day walker, and I have done bits and pieces of the walk before. But, yeah, this was the first time I'd really set out to do a 1,000-mile trip, albeit in stages.
All right. Is it an official thing? Does it have a name, or is it just a case of you walk the whole coast?
Well, it does now, I hope. I call it Dreamtime to Eden, but that's just my name. So Dreamtime Beach is a beach very close to the New South Wales border with Queensland. That just sounded like a nice place to start and some acknowledgement to traditional owners. And that, you know, it is actually the name of a real place. And Eden is the last sort of town of any size in New South Wales next to the Victorian border. So partly for the poetry, but it's more, I suppose, a little bit like the big coastal walk in the UK, the King Charles III walk, where they sort of have stitching together a lot of name walks. And then you've got some intermediate bits where you walk through a town or you cross a bridge over a river, things like that. So as yet, it isn't seen as something to do. So I'm trying very hard to promote it, not necessarily as what I've called it. There's interest, but local government, we've got sort of local government and then kind of regional sort of concerns. And then you've got state government and different, it sort of differs. So within local government areas, there's a lot, people understand the value of walking tourism and related things, mountain biking, they now call it wallets with wheels, that, they're starting to get more involved. But I think it tends to be much more at the local level and people aren't realizing, I use my model is like the Camino. How many people around the world do the Camino because it's just something they've heard about and it seems doable and there's accommodation along the way. So yeah, I kind of refer to this as just a coastal Camino. Do 1,000 miles and you'll see incredible stuff. At the end of the day, it's not that hard. You're not that far away from transport or support. There's some wild parts, of course, but generally speaking, you're never more than a few kilometres from a town or a road or a little bit of civilisation.
There's no law that says you have to do it all in one go. You could do it over weekends, months.
I did it in 80 days and very roughly 16 five-day stages. And at the beginning of that time, I was working quite a bit, but as a consultant. So I might work for 3 months and then I might have 3 weeks off. So then in that period, I was doing it. This year, I had a little bit more free time. So I did, in effect, the second half, did that in about 8 months. But again, I'd either get a train or a bus or transport to the beginning of the walk, do 5 or 6 days, and then end up in a place where I could get a bus or a train back to my home in Sydney.
You enjoy the planning part of it?
Oh, absolutely. The experience is the highlight, but the planning and anticipation is fantastic. And then also the reflection. I write articles for a magazine for it. And, kind of like a lot of us after a great holiday, you go through the photos and the discipline of writing about it and then trying to imagine what's the key information people need, not overburdening them with too much. And then you've always got this secret little space that, these places that only you feel like you've experienced something that, nobody else will ever feel. And Australia is even on this part of the coast, a lot wilder perhaps than, many parts of Europe. I mean, you don't see many people along the way unless you're right near the town. You walk a few kilometres down a beach, you got it to yourself. You're swimming with dolphins. There's whales out in the ocean. There's eagles overhead. It really is amazing. But then, as I say, it's not actually, you're not in the middle of, the Yukon or somewhere way, so way off track that you're in survival mode.
As you're in Australia, is heat and extreme sun an issue when you're walking there?
New South Wales is a temperate zone, so it's a little bit, I guess, in a European context, a bit like, say, Italy, sort of, days of kind of 12 degrees to 20 degrees Celsius. I think peak summer, which is our peak sort of holiday season, which would be mid-December to the end of January, there you can get, hot days, and I think you'd have to worry about it. Up the north coast, so north of Sydney, I tended to wear a hat with a sort of a neck flap, something like those old Foreign Legion caps would have. I mean, you've got to be sun aware, which I think most people in Australia are, because you're going to be out on exposed beaches and headlands, particularly up north. The beaches can be long. But other than, a hat, some sun cream, just remembering to put the sun cream, things like the tops of your knees, there can be little parts of you that you forget about. But I walked north to south, and in the southern hemisphere, of course, that meant the sun was behind me, so it wasn't really much. And of course, in terms of being hot, you're walking next to the ocean, and it's always there. And the ocean temperature, even in summer, it's cool. It doesn't get, I mean, the water temperature in New South Wales generally is sort of in the very low 20s, so it's just ideal. Probably for people from the UK, it would seem perfectly ideal. But for us, it's a, just a, you know, it's always got a tinge of coolness about it. So if I ever felt a bit hot, I'd just jump in the water. There's nobody around. You just take your shirt and your pants off and dive in.
And what are the beaches like there for walking on? I know that sometimes when we're walking on the beach, you feel like you're taking one step forward and two steps back because your feet are sinking into the sand and it gets a bit difficult.
It's actually quite different. So, of course, at low tide or sort of mid to low tide, it's really like a highway up north, and that's pretty typical. But often they're flat and quite hard. The sand will be quite hard. So, most of the time, there are the odd small coves where you might be on something a bit soft and whatever. But everybody sort of said to me, oh, walking on sand, it's so difficult. But I found it completely the opposite. For 90% of the time, you're walking on a firm surface with just a little bit of give. I walked with poles, and I found it great. You don't have to worry about navigation. You sort of get into, I think, your guest Lee was saying about, you get into this almost meditative, it's kind of like a walking meditation state. Sometimes at the northern headland of the beach, I'd think, oh, look how far away that next headland is. And then I just find, as so often happens, you'd get into this rhythm, you'd get into this lovely, calm, gentle, relaxed mental mode, and you'd sort of come back to earth, so to speak, and, oh, I'm here already. So probably the longest beaches are, well, there's some really long ones, but on average, of sort of what I'd think of as a long beach would be about 10 kilometres. So it's a couple of hours of walking, but nothing that's too forbidding. There's just one beach near Newcastle, which is the second biggest city in New South Wales, and that's a 34-kilometre beach. So that's one to kind of treat with a bit of respect. But it's not that far away from a road that has a regular bus service, so you can just walk it till you don't want to walk it anymore, and then just turn right and head inland and catch the bus. But other than that, they're all pretty good. And I think the walking, it's fair to say, the sand is quite firm if the water has been there. And it's only if you're on a smaller beach that you might get that very steep, softish sand.
All right. Are there any access issues along that 1,000 miles?
No, I mean, the sort of the general answer is no. All the coast is in public hands. Of course, there's the odd pinch point. So there's just a few little bits where land grants were done not according to the formula, where all beaches and all coastal land is in public hands. Generally, those places will allow walkers through. There's very, very few of them. I mean, over the 1,000 miles, there's probably about 10 miles where, you might have to walk around something, or, you just kind of have to go inland back to the road. But both stretches, the sort of northern way from the northern border to Sydney and the southern way from Sydney to Eden, you've got a road, you know, a main arterial road not that far away. So you're never truly lost. And I wasn't the greatest planner. Like the few bits where it would be good to know what you're doing and ask for permission, I didn't bother. And half the time you just turned up and there was a track there or an open gate. So it was obviously fine. And then there's one restricted beach, which is an Air Force bombing practice range. And that's up near a town called Evans Head. But as you walk down to that beach, it's like a sort of a Roadrunner and Coyote cartoon. You know, the signs get, you know, warning, you know, they get bigger and bigger and more dangerous till like the final sign sort of says, people have died on this beach from unexploded ordnance or something. Yeah, you kind of go, okay, I'll turn back. But really, compared to most countries, it's astonishing how easily, you know, I mean, I literally started the walk. I flew up to an airport on the Gold Coast, which is a bit south of Brisbane, walked out of the airport, walked a few hundred metres to the beach and turned right and started walking.
So that's always one of the things with long distance trails is that sometimes signage is missing and you're not sure where to go. But I guess if you're just walking along the edge of the coast, you can't really go wrong.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there is the odd pinch point where, you know, some of the headlands are very steep and large. And I found I got very slack after a while because generally, yeah, if the headland looks impossible, the trail around it will just start where it would logically, you know, there's a saddle or the headland kind of comes down. 90% of the time, you walk to the end of the beach and it's fairly obvious either you can walk around the rock shelf or there's a trail. A lot of the areas where people live nearby, of course, people want to walk to the headland lookout, etc. So often as not, you've just got a, you know, quite an easy path over the headlands. And then the only other significant thing is there's a lot of large rivers, as there would be anywhere on the coast. But all of the large rivers have bridges or ferries. And I found the bridges and the ferries were great kind of markers of, you know, you'd finish a day with a ferry ride or you might finish a stage of a walk crossing a bridge. And in our geography lessons, we sort of learned the great rivers of northern New South Wales. So you'd sort of cross them and go, oh, now I've crossed the Tweed. Now I've crossed the Richmond. Now I've crossed the Clarence. So I found that a joy. And none of them present anything that you'd worry about. And there's down south, there are some places where it's great to swim. You know, they're tidal inlets. We call them icols, intermittently closed and open lakes and lagoons. So sometimes you're wading. Every now and again, you'd swim. And I mean, I used a thing I got actually from the UK, a thing called a ruck raft. I just put my pack on something like a sort of a blow-up life ring and swim across them. But they're short and very easily swam. And if you don't want to swim or you're a non-swimmer, you could simply walk into the town a few kilometres away and walk across a road bridge.
And what about the variety? I mean, you mentioned 1,000 beaches. Is it all beaches or are there kind of forested parts that you go through? And
there's plenty of alternatives. I mean, I was trying to do every beach and every headland. So wherever possible, I stuck to the beach. But there's a lot of name walks. I think you've had somebody previously on your show talking about a new one of these. So they're sort of the national parks here have made these great walks, and quite a few of them are in the coastal areas. So they tend to be what most hikers, more like what most hikers would imagine. So, you know, Murramarang, for example, it'd be 3 or 4 days. You know, you'd be on tracks, so they'd come down to a little beach. You might stop at the beach for a swim, but then you'd be on tracks again. And all of those walks, which, you know, I'm very happy to supply details if any listeners are interested, but they're all pretty easily found through a bit of internet research. The New South Wales National Parks is called the National Parks and Wildlife Service, and all those walks and the route maps and track notes and everything would be on their website. And all those walks have designated camping spots, or a lot of them would have cabins or a real roof as opposed to a canvas roof to stay. So whenever those walks existed, I of course would follow them. But sometimes there are inland paths you could take, and a lot of keen hikers like to do that. But I found just the being next to the ocean, the breezes, whale season here is from May to November, and it's just, it's incredible when you're a bit away from the town. All wildlife is better when it's further away from humans, but quite often I'd be swimming with dolphins and there'd be whales sort of in the middle distance, and it was so common I'd almost expect it. It's like, I want to go for a swim now, you know, where's my dolphins, where's my whales? I mean, come on boys, yeah, it's time to gather around. So that site for me, that marine life was just unbelievable, and I'm aware of it. And of course in Sydney we see dolphins and whales if we want to, you know, go to a headland, you'll see them. But there's something about being, you know, in my case, I was solitary by yourself on a long lonely beach, and just experiencing that was really, really, you know, almost spiritual.
Yeah, I can imagine. What kind of distances were you covering every day?
Like many people, I started off ambitious. And then as we were discussing before the show, you find when you're taking photos, I found that 20 kilometres was a good distance. I'd start sort of pre-sunrise. And I found with 20 kilometres, I never had to think about my destination. You know, I'd just do whatever I wanted to do. And by the time I sort of had done what I wanted to do, I'd be, you know, just at the time I was thinking, oh, you know, like a kind of a cold beer would go down well, I'd be, oh, I've only got 1 kilometre to go or something. So I think 20 kilometres is a good anchor point, which is about sort of, you know, 12, 13 miles. You can do longer. Some days I did longer, but I think once you're tired, you miss a lot. Like you might be walking and it might be a 2 mile additional walk out to the tip of a headland. And if you're sort of trying to cover great distances, you'll just say, oh, I can avoid that. But often those side routes were to the most spectacular places. So I think anybody thinking of doing it, I think, yeah, that 12, 13 miles, 20 kilometres a day is probably a good anchor. And the towns, it's a bit of a generalisation, but they tend to be that sort of distance apart. Obviously, Australia's a bit more spread out than the UK. That's probably a good way to think of the distances to cover each day.
And is there accommodation in most of those places?
Yeah, so everywhere, Australia has a great love of caravan parks. So everywhere would have caravan parks where you could, if you had a tent, you could camp and use their, you know, shower and cooking facilities. They have what we call on-site vans. So they're sort of cabins, and you know, that would be with a roof. And almost every town has hotels and motels, which are sort of the range, about £50 a night. So pretty economical for fully serviced accommodation. That was the main sort of places I'd stay in, and they're designed for sort of commercial travellers, you know, people that kind of arrive in the afternoon and leave in the morning. I stayed sometimes if I had a support crew, I'd stay in an Airbnb, and we might stay there and sort of do the walk-in stages around there. But yeah, accommodate outside our peak period, which is mid-December to sort of mid-January, mid to late January, it's very, very easy. There's a few other sort of local school holidays, but if you're not in school holiday time, you almost don't have to worry. I mean, I did pre-book, but you'd be very unlucky to get into a town and find everything booked up. It's just not the population density that there is in Europe, so you just don't really have to worry about that. But for me, I just sometimes, if you weren't sure what timing or whatever it was, and it's easy enough just to book on a, you know, booking app site, all of them here, and you know, every accommodation in Australia would have a, you know, website or be on booking.com or hotels.com, etc.
But the same for food?
Yes, again, you don't really have to worry. There's a brilliant national park walk called Yürügyer, which is in the sort of northern part of the state, and just it's a named national park walk. In that place, there are very small towns. So it's very easy. You can do it over, I guess, 3 nights, 4 days. In those towns, there might only be one little general store, and that might close at 4. So you've just got to make sure you don't sort of assume it's city hours. But it's really pretty easy to, and even in those places, you could probably buy, you know, there'd be a club or a pub, as we'd say, like a hotel, where you could, you know, go and buy a cooked meal, again, probably pretty restricted hours. But yeah, it's not an issue, not an issue at all. And yeah, you've just got to think about your 5-day stretch and say, okay, there's a town there, what time's the shop open, what time does the club open? But I found it, and I was surprised at the quality. When I was younger, I've lived in Southeast Asia for many years, so I was kind of expecting the pretty limited range there'd be from, you know, sort of 30 or 40 years ago. But actually, you know, it's gourmet coffee and, you know, sandwiches on, you know, some kind of multi-grain Turkish bread. Like, it was absolutely good. And I feel pretty reasonable value. I mean, everybody's got their price points, but, and you can go into local supermarkets and, you know, buy tins of beans and live on that if your budget's stretched. But I found both the accommodation and the food to be surprisingly good quality and you know, in my opinion, quite reasonable value, certainly compared to Europe. I think somebody coming from a holiday in the UK would say, well, you know, that's pretty good. I've got pretty good place to stay and pretty good food for not too much money.
Were you recording this along the way for people to read, or did you wait till the end before you did that?
So I did it in stages. And so what I'd do is each day I'd put a post up on Facebook, and I was pretty scrupulous about that. I wanted to use that like a journal. So typically I'd put like a 300 to 500 word post and maybe 10 images up at the end of each day. And I'm very glad I did that. And then about the third stage, a magazine called Bushwalk Magazine, I just somehow they got to me through my Facebook post. And they asked me to write about each stage. So I've written articles on each stage, and that's bushwalk.com. It's a great magazine for anybody who's thinking to walk in Australia. Lots of information. It's free. And then my articles, I started writing June 24, and every issue since they've been appearing there. So, of course, like with all publication, I think we're only up to stage 9. I've finished the walk, but I'm kind of reliving it by writing those articles. And then, yeah, I've been sort of doing podcasts. I write bits and pieces for other publications, but for the whole walk, I'm documenting it there. And then I'm in the process of writing a book, which, yeah, publication is a strange beast, but that's under consideration.
Are you planning on doing, I don't know, Queensland next or another one, or Victoria maybe?
I'm actually, rather than going bigger, I'm going smaller. So what my current project is walking all of the foreshores of Sydney Harbour, partly because I can do this from home, so my wife doesn't have to get grumpy that I keep on going away for 5 or 6 days. Sydney Harbour is lots of little bays and inlets, and of course you can just walk it, you can do the short version, but I'm doing the long version, trying to imagine what it would have been like to walk it, you know, I guess at European settlement, you know, walking every bay, every inlet. So it actually turns out to be 200 miles. So it's a fair walk. And it's already, I mean, I know that I've done all these walks a million times, but the discipline of not crossing any bridge, suddenly I'm walking up these little inlets that I just had no idea. And some of them, it's a bit sad. You know, there's a bit of industry and, you know, the little inlets become a concrete drain. But that being said, reading the history of it, reading about the first normally English contact when explorers would be searching these has been great. But also there's been a lot of work to rehabilitate these, you know, especially in the upper reaches of the harbour. So, yeah, so far I'm about, it's probably about a 20-day walk all up. And I'm about 5 days into that. And again, I'll sort of documenting it and trying to, you know, put it together as a cohesive whole. We do have some very named walks. So we have this one called the Bondi to Manly Walk, which links sort of our two most popular beaches. And that would walk around the harbour foreshores but cross the Sydney Harbour Bridge. But that's altogether about 80K, so 50 miles. So once you go west of the Sydney Harbour Bridge, you know, you've got another 150 miles of walking. And surprisingly, as well as with the beaches in Sydney, I think for people from the UK, you would feel not quite wilderness, but there's many parts. I mean, the wildlife is still astonishing. There's still plenty of indigenous birds, etc., around. So it's certainly not just walking along suburban streets.
I remember visiting Tasmania, and on a map it looks small compared to the rest of Australia, but it's huge. I mean, even to do the coastline of Tasmania would take you months. So it's there's obviously plenty of scope for doing walks there.
I mean, look, every state has its own magnificence. I think New South Wales just suits me. I don't know whether it's just because I know it well. I think the scale of some of the bigger states, there are people that have walked all around Australia, but they tend to be sort of pushing wheelbarrows. They've got to be on highways a lot of the time. I mean, it's too vast for me. That's kind of a level up. And I think it's sort of, I don't have a lot of interest in road walking or covering huge territory. I think this coast walk for me was very much how people would have seen the Camino or something. It was a sort of journey of a lifetime. I felt, I started out a reasonably happy bloke, but I ended up a much happier one. And I kind of really felt a power in just the doing of it. And then as we were talking about in the preparing and planning for it, and then now in the reflection of it, and it's like you've charged up and you want to share it because it's so magnificent.
What were some of the highlights for you?
The swimming with the dolphins was incredible. There's so many great places. Like every stage of the walk, I'd think, yeah, it just can't get better. I'm satisfied that this is going to be the best. And then the next stage would be even better. I mentioned Yuragi National Park, and that's really, it's rehabilitated, but that's, you really feel like you're out there. All of the national park name walks, as we say, these great walks in New South Wales are fantastic. I really love Diamond Head, which is where a famous Australian writer called Kylie Tennant wrote from, and there's a lot of sort of rich literary history there as well as just being spectacular. But often it's the time of year. One place can be amazing because you see a pod of whales and they're all breaching, and the next person that comes along 2 days later isn't going to have that same experience. I think for really wild fields or people that already have been to New South Wales and know the coast pretty well, the far south coast is the least travelled, and it is geologically spectacular, which makes it a little bit more difficult for walking. But for me, I wasn't really that familiar with it, and so I just had too many days where I just at the end of the day just be like, it can't be any better than that. And then the next day, it'd be like, but this is so amazing, this is even better. So there's not a bad day, even in Sydney. So it's about 8 days of walking if you sort of walk the northern beaches and around Sydney Harbour to the Harbour Bridge and back around and down to Cronulla. But on the headlands, even on the beaches, you have a lot of it to yourself a lot of the time, and there's just spectacular places. You're just as likely to see the marine life in Sydney as anywhere else. And I'd often have to be sitting at Long Reef or somewhere and just think, I'm at the edge of a city of 5.5 million people, and yet I'm looking at this wonderful display, or I'm just sitting by myself on a headland. And so yeah, it really is just in every way, I just can't recommend it highly enough.
And at that pace as well, I think you think more and you feel more than you do if you're doing it quickly.
I think so. I mean, everybody's got different motivations, and when I read some people who've done parts of the New South Wales coast have done it in astonishing times, I just go like, oh wow, I'm taking 16 days to do that, and that guy did it in 6. But I think to appreciate the stillness, what this coast walk offers is just that ability to relatively safely get away from it all. So, my experience in many other places, like say walking in Borneo, it's great, but you've got to have your machete with you. You've got to be aware all the time. You can get lost very easily. It's jungle. You can't see anything. But this walk, it's relatively safe, and yet you get that incredible feel that I imagine people that are alone in wildernesses on 50-day treks feel. It's just really, really incredible how isolated it feels, and yet it doesn't have the danger element that normal isolation has.
And I guess, as you were saying, with knowing that there's accommodation and food and communities, you don't have that sense of, oh, I've got to get here, or am I going fast enough to finish the day? You have that kind of relaxation just in the walk itself.
I think so. And I think in the very wild parts, there's a national park not far north of Sydney, about 200 miles north of Sydney, called Myall Lakes. But there it's really isolated. You feel really by yourself. And I had to find a track There's like a huge area of sand dunes, many, many square miles of dunes. So you're sort of in these dunes and kind of know there's going to be a track, but it's incredible when you're by yourself and you're just in this, you know, looks like the moon, and you're sort of looking for something. And I think if you were doing that under stress, if you thought, well, I've still got 22 kilometers to go, I said I'd meet somebody at the end, or, you know, I've got to get to that campground, I was relaxed and just thinking, look, it's 10 a.m. I know it's here somewhere. I'll just drop my pack down. I'll, you know, drink a bit of coffee out of my thermos. I'll walk around and I'll go to that edge. I'll go to that edge. Stay calm. Some sections you could cover vast distances and there'd be no problem. But it's beautiful to be by yourself out there. But it's also, I think, if you make a bad decision, that's when you veer into the risky side. I didn't carry a locator beacon. But if anybody was worried, they issue them at national parks, often police stations, or, you know, you can just buy them very cheaply these days. I found mobile reception was good enough. Generally, the headlands are high, the beaches are flat. You know, 90% of the way, the phone was fine. And I just downloaded sort of offline Google Maps, and the satellite ping works even when you're in flight mode. I don't know if that's everywhere, but certainly in Australia it does. So, you know, I could just, if I was worried where I was, I'd just, you know, sit down and open up Google Maps and have a look where the locator beacon said. And you mentioned earlier, it's pretty easy as you can just keep that water on. If you're walking south, you just keep the water on one side and keep the land on the other side and keep going in that direction. So navigation is really an issue.
I've had various reactions from different people. When I get toward the end of a long distance trail, I get a little bit sad that it's almost over, whereas a lot of people get motivated by the end of it. What did you feel like when you were getting close to finishing?
Every stage, I felt that, you know, is it sort of Keats' ode to melancholy or something? I mean, for me, much closer to you. I drew out the last bits because it was just such a purely joyful experience. I really didn't want it to end. And indeed, if it sort of, you know, life circumstances, if somebody had just said, well, do you want to turn around and go back? I would have gone in a heartbeat. I think there's something nice about, I guess, you know, anthropologists would say it's creating an artifact. You know, you've done it, but I didn't want it to end. And I mean, we still, of course, it's not like the coast is going anywhere. It's 300 million years old and it'll, you know, be around a lot longer than humanity will be. So, we often go. But now when I walk anywhere on the coast, I've got this delicious memory. And doing it as part of a larger enterprise gave it a lot of meaning. My wife and I just had a short holiday at a place called Port Stephens, and we did a sort of two-day walk that was part of it. And I just found every little micro detail. I could remember sitting on that little rock. I could remember, you know, trying to take a photo of that canyon, but the water sprayed over me or whatever. It's so fresh and real, and so just it heightens my enjoyment of the coast even more.
And does it motivate you to want to keep going and doing other things? I know you're doing that one around Sydney, but are you constantly planning for other things?
Yes and no. I think I'm more now trying to focus on sharing, not only in the sort of hiking community. Like, one thing that was surprising on my Facebook post was the number of people who are housebound, you know, perhaps through a disability, sometimes through age, sometimes just a temporary, you know, they've had an operation. But there was a lot more people than I realised who wanted to sort of feel out there. So I'm starting to do a bit of that, of just photos and video and kind of a walkthrough, but second person. So, you know, you are out there, you know, you turn this corner, you see this. And I think I'm not looking for another sort of 80-day, around the world in 80 days experience. I've traveled a lot, and I think a lot of the great walks, I love hearing about the, you know, the Pacific Northwest Trail, or the, you know, read about the King Charles III Coast Walk, but I somehow doubt that I'll really be doing those. I'm never say never, but this one I feel is kind of mine.
And I guess as well that even with any trail, you could do it in the opposite direction or at a different time of year. And every time you walk any stretch, it's always different.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, if people, you know, were kind of having a holiday to Australia and wanting to know, generally the articles I write in Bushwalk magazine are for a 5 or 6 day section. And in many ways, for many people, that's feasible. They're having a, you know, a 2 week holiday along the coast. And they tend to be, the stage is tended to be determined by something like, from one big river to the next big river, or, fairly logical geographic start and endpoints. So I think that that's more, I've had quite a few people have written to me saying, I just did that section, it was brilliant. Doing the whole thing, we grow into this often. I mean, sometimes there are young people that just want to do them as through hikes, but for some reason, maybe I'm a bit OCD, but I just really liked, you'd sort of finish at Ballina and then, 2 weeks later, you'd come up to Ballina and start, and I wonder what the next bit, I wonder what's around the next corner. So I personally loved that. But yeah, definitely it can be done in stages. Lots of tourists come to Sydney and it's an expensive city, but walking it, so you catch a ferry somewhere and you walk and I mean, as I said earlier, there's 100 beaches in Sydney. Everybody goes to Bondi, but honestly, it's probably one of the less beautiful beaches. I mean, they're just astonishing. And I mean, the northern beaches, which very few tourists go to, and they are just jaw-droppingly beautiful. They are right up there with the best beaches in the world. So I think for anybody that loves their walking, even Sydney is absolutely a walker's paradise.
The other thing I didn't mention was this is a long walk that you did. Did the weather comply all the time?
The weather in New South Wales has become a little bit less predictable, but it tends to come in stretches. So you'll get 5 or 6 days of blue sky and sunshine, and then you'll get 2 or 3 days of sort of stormy, rainy weather. Now, that's a sort of a very generalized pattern. I'd kind of look 30 days in advance and try to see. So obviously, photography, I have had complaints of people that sort of say, oh, when I was in Byron Bay, it rained every day. And it's like, how come all your photos are blue sky? But so there was an element of planning it. It's a very different experience in the sunshine to in the rain. We have things called southerly busters here where it'll be beautiful, often when it gets hot and it's been hot for a few days, and suddenly it'll just turn and the wind will turn from sort of the northeast to the south, and you'll just get gale and clouds, and they often made for very dramatic experiences. And at first it was like, oh great, it's cooling down, it's nice, and then the little white clouds turned to grey clouds, and then after an hour or so of thinking isn't this refreshing, suddenly just driving rain and walking southwards, it's right in your face. And I only had a few of those, and I can remember each time I had to swim across a river in a southerly, and the track notes had said, don't worry, there'll always be people paddling their boards around and it'll be fine. When I got there, a huge howling southerly, and it was 20 meters away from civilization and warmth, but there was no way anybody was going to come and pick me up from the sandbar across the river. But what I'm describing as dramatic southerly, probably for anybody that walks in winter and walks up Snowdon or something in winter, would laugh at my pathetic, sort of warm climate self. So you never, beyond a rain jacket and a sweater, you'd never need anything, gloves or anything like that.
All right, well, thanks so much for doing this. Any other things that you'd like to add?
I'm very happy to answer anybody's questions. So I've got a website which is gregkeeney.com. And I mean, probably rather than give emails and all of that, if anybody was interested, firstly on the website, there's a daily blog of the walk. Every day of the walk is listed there. So anybody that wanted the information, there's also contact details, and very happy to answer emails or give suggestions or provide advice.
Every time we talk about a walk somewhere, I want to go out and do it. Nice weather and beaches and dolphins do sound kind of tempting. And what a walk it sounds like, so thanks to Greg for that. If you do have questions for Greg, if you're headed to New South Wales, do please get in touch with him. If you do have news or suggestions for podcast guests, please do get in touch through jim@walkingpost.com. It's getting chilly here, but at least this weekend is supposed to be fine. Funny how the entire weekend is determined by the weather when you live in Scotland. It's also starting to get darker a lot earlier as well. Either way, I hope we get some walking in somewhere. So I hope you enjoyed this week's WalkingPost.com podcast, and I hope you have a great week ahead, hopefully with all the Halloween candy already bought and your candy trail prepared if you're headed out. So until next time, happy trails! Walking Post from walkingpost.com is an Air Coastal Media Limited production.